Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and on today's show, we'll look at some news on Operation Rio Grande, the closure of a section of Rio Grande Street, also the bargain struck between industry officials and clean energy groups on net metering for people with solar panels, and a draft legislative proposal, or a proposal at least, to do away with the food sales tax in Utah. Those and other stories on the program today. And joining us for this conversation are Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson. Lee, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also, government reporter Matt Piper is in studio. Thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod, good morning to you. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, welcome to you as well.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'd like to hear from you during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Weigh in with the stories that we're covering today by calling us at 801-355-8255, or you can post your comments and questions at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Operation Rio Grande. I stumbled through the introduction here, Matt, because there's some relatively new news on this. But actually, let's start with a look at the projected costs of this operation and then move to the more recent news coming out on this. Earlier this week, we got a look at the projected long-term budget for Operation Rio Grande. How much money is it that is needed for this, and who's paying for what?
Yeah, so they figure that 67, and when I say they, talking about a collaboration between state, county, and city officials, figure they need about $67 million for 2 years worth of this operation, which is right now sort of a law enforcement crackdown, but which also involves a treatment component and an as yet sort of unspecified employment opportunity component. And so of the $67 million, we know that the city would pay $10 million. We know that there's a funding gap between the three of about $21 million. Mm-hmm. The state has, through House Speaker Greg Hughes and the governor's office, the state has sort of offered unofficially to provide about half of that gap.
Right. Tacit and commitment of what, 20 or how much?
So the gap's $21 million, so the state would provide an additional $10.5 million that they haven't yet been able to find a source for, while the city and county would sort of split the remainder. And the city's total portion of this is not super high, maybe you might think. You'd say $10 million out of $67 million for a city problem, but the city likes to point out that they have I think in this year's budget, they had $11 million toward this area anyway, and so they feel that they are already sort of doing their part, to which Speaker Hughes has said, you know, well, the state and county are also doing things beyond Operation Rio Grande that apply to people in that area.
Okay.
So anyway, that's sort of what we know about the budget at this point.
Sort of, and so there are some bones of contention in that budgeting question, and there are other points of contention that have to do, and this is the more breaking news, or that have had to do with the proposed closure of a portion of Rio Grande Street where the shelter and other service providers are located. And this is something that earlier in the week kind of came to a head on a radio show, KSL's Doug Wright show, where Speaker Hughes and Jackie Piskupski were both on the line. Maybe tell us about that as background, and then we'll jump into the more breaking news.
Yeah, should we try to get the speaker and the mayor on the line here right now?
Yeah, we got to
call him up.
355-8255.
Yeah, so it was sort of the first public, you can call it a spat, I guess, if you wanted, in this whole operation, where the speaker called for the mayor to exercise her authority to immediately temporarily close Rio Grande Street, which is between the shelter and the Catholic Community Services facilities. And the mayor apparently expressed some hesitancy, wanting there to be a public process and to have some assurance that this is what the city council and community members wanted before she got the ball rolling toward what would ultimately be a two-year closure of the Rio Grande Street and would lead, at least in the plans we've heard about, to a sort of fenced-off area where broader public access would be limited by the possession of an ID card.
Yeah, and that's an interesting – I want to talk about that in greater depth. But yesterday we heard Mayor Biskupski along with Speaker Greg Hughes announced that this street, Rio Grande, or a portion of this street, would be indeed closed. This is the temporary closure that Mayor Jackie Biskupski has the authority to do. To car traffic, at least. I don't know. This doesn't include that whole plan of fencing in the area and having ID cards yet.
Sure. So Greg Hughes yesterday had hoped to get the mayor to sign a lease agreement that would lease that property to the state with the sort of caveat that it could be undone by city council or city council action or legislative inaction. They need a sort of a waiver of sorts on a rule that would relinquish the city's claim to the street if they leased it for a certain period of time, and they expect that they're going to get that. But what Greg walked away with yesterday was a temporary closure to vehicle traffic. That's as far as Mayor Biskupski was willing to go. And then she announced that there is a city survey on the topic, and next Wednesday there's a community forum at 6 p.m. at the Gateway where community members can let the speaker and the mayor know what they think about the implications of the vision as is sort of vaguely defined right now.
The state's idea here, or the idea, I guess, that maybe has broader buy-in now, is to do what the service providers are already doing down there, which is screen people to see if they're under the influence of drugs or alcohol before letting them into this sort of fenced-off area, which would be a portion of this street that's now closed to traffic. And that would essentially make it safer, according to these guys, for people seeking services or for simply, you know, having a place to be. It would be a safer place to be, is their idea.
I think so. I mean, we really need more details about the enclosed courtyard plan. That what they would be screened for is not entirely clear to me. I think the idea is not so much drug users, but drug dealers would not want to go get an ID card that would give them access to this area, and this area would be sort of more intimately policed. Mm. But I'm not entirely sure where the line would be drawn and what the implications would be for people with criminal histories who are trying to access homeless services.
Okay. Well, and you would imagine that a lot of people with criminal histories would be trying to access homeless services. What do the service providers who operate there say about this closure, of this proposed closure of the street with a fenced-in area?
I think the Catholic Community Services, much of this is based on their own courtyard, and I think they've been happy to tout the success of their own homeless services ID card. I think all service providers have sort of been pleased that somebody's doing something about the problem that in the area, the lawlessness, because the road home, as much as it's associated with that lawlessness, really doesn't like having, very much doesn't like having that element surrounding the people who are receiving its services. But the road home, which is sort of the biggest service provider that manages an 1,100 bed shelter there, has been pretty much radio silent on the proposals that have yet to be defined.
Trying to maybe stay out of the politics of it. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, you wrote about this in a column this week, and where you said that Mayor Biskupski essentially needed to act to close this road. That's now happened.
Well, it's in the process of happening, I guess, in some sort of half step, half measure. This is an idea that has been floated around for several months, and so to say that we didn't have time to get our head, get our arms around it and figure out what it's going to look like is, I think, maybe not entirely accurate. It's an idea that I didn't feel good about when Jim Winder proposed it, former Sheriff Winder, because it felt like, you're herding your homeless people into these pens, these chain link pens, and what is this? Some sort of urban zoo, I think I called it. But the on the flip side of it, you have distinct populations of homeless people in this area. You have the people who are, truly homeless and down there looking for services, because that's where all the services are right now. And then you have the people that Matt mentioned who are, doing drugs or dealing drugs. So you have people who need, mental health treatment. if you separate the populations, you know, and create that safe space, as they're calling it, then you can focus your resources in a more targeted fashion to try to make sure you're getting law enforcement where law enforcement needs to be, the people who are there looking for services feel safe. And so it's something that needs to be done. We've seen some progress, as I mentioned in the column this week, that we've seen some progress as a result of this Operation Rio Grande. And if we don't continue to keep the momentum going, I felt like there was a real risk that we were going to slip backwards. You know, those elements were going to return to the park. You can't sustain the type of police presence that we've had there for the last several weeks. And so you need to do something else to kind of solidify the progress you've made. And I just felt like the mayor was being a little obstructionist with that.
Okay, go ahead.
I think what she's kind of, yesterday's announcement, I think, was sort of maybe a little bit of saving face and taking at least a small step in the right direction. I think they need to keep moving that ball forward and keep it going.
Robert, because you can opine on these things, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, are the dealers, you know, and by that I mean the people who are actually making drugs, making money, selling drugs, mm-hmm. not making the drugs necessarily, but couldn't a lot of them conceivably pass the screening that would allow them into this area that is, you know, supposedly separating out the two groups?
I think that depends on how they're going to do it. I mean, the mayor mentions actually having dogs down there who would help with the screening. I think you probably would need some sort of metal detectors possibly to screen out weapons so you don't end up with an enclosed place with weapons involved. But, you know, I think it sort of depends on what degree of screening they have. And then that raises problems. You know, if you have intensive screening coming in and out of that area, might be more difficult, right? So, you know, these are things that still need to be worked out, I think, in the near term. But, you know, you've also got to start the ball rolling and start building the perimeter there that you need in place.
Matt Piper, we're waiting to see whether that fence part will happen. Essentially, there's the, as you said, this review process. There's a survey that is, I guess, at the city's website, probably. What happens next in this story?
And that's an excellent point. I think the part of Speaker Hughes' frustration was with the mayor's sort of at least temporary refusal to close the street, is that the more specific elements of this are going to be articulated during a public process at some point. They have to be. The city council has to sign off on a longer term closure, and so they're going to at least hear what the broader vision for this area is at some point before giving the okay. And even some council members had said, in the meantime, there's no risk to just shutting this street down to I don't even think they were as specific as saying to vehicular traffic. I think they were just saying to going ahead with the state's plan, because it can be vetted in the coming month. So that's kind of the next step, is to see where they stand and see what this more specific vision is, and to have the speaker describe, or whoever is involved, describe how the ID cards are going to work, what this is going to look like, whether there's some prioritization of people receiving services. All those questions remain unanswered at this point.
How people get those ID cards. I mean, what if you don't have documentation to prove who you are? I mean, these are a lot of questions. But
yeah.
I want to just turn to the overall Operation Rio Grande for a second, put this in context, and look at the money that's needed and the projects that are being carried out. And one question that I have is how the effectiveness of the overall operation is being measured, both as it goes and then, you know, when it's done. Is there a way to say this is successful? I mean, a number of arrests have been made, but is that progress toward solving the overall issue?
And the trick to it is the speedy timeline that's often been referenced by the lieutenant governor. I can't remember exactly what he says, but he likes to say that it's been months worth of work and, you know, a couple of weeks since from the time that Governor Herbert called the summit to 2 weeks later when they had, you know, the officers descending on the area and the helicopter circling the block. One thing that it did was it made it difficult to have a baseline. To measure a baseline. So I think one thing that the West Side that makes it difficult to verify the accounts from West Side and other Salt Lake City community members who say that the crime is spreading to their neighborhoods is we don't really know what it looked like before, for sure, in a way that we can measure this against. I think that's always going to be difficult with this. I think that with Operation Rio Grande, even if the area itself looks better, and it looks much, much better today, you know, than it did 3 weeks ago, and from the at least from the standpoint of people committing crimes brazenly, that you'll never really be able to precisely measure the overall effect on the community. But I, you know, that doesn't mean that it can't be. You can't take a stab at it.
If I could jump in, I think you know, they talked about the three phases of this, and we're in phase two now. I'm not seeing yet the treatment coming online that needs to come online, the funding there for the drug and mental health treatment that needs to be done. And so they're kind of counting on this, getting this Medicaid waiver that they think the Trump administration could approve and could take effect by November 1st. If they get that in place, they can treat hundreds, actually close to 2,000 more people than they've been treating. But you can't arrest your way out of this, right? And it does end up being a bit of a revolving door, and people are going to end up back down in that area or somewhere else out on the street. And so you've got to get those other pieces in place, and they're the more expensive, the more difficult pieces to do. It's the mental health and substance abuse treatment, and it's the affordable housing. Right. And then ultimately, the housing is going to be the big clincher, right? So those are the pieces that we're still kind of waiting to see when they're going to be coming online and how effective they're going to be. Because again, right now, this is, as Matt kind of mentioned, this has been a law enforcement first operation.
Right, Matt, and that aspect of it, the fact that. You know, this is definitely a far cry from the housing first model that we saw sort of picking up steam a couple of years ago, where you just provided homeless people with housing. This is something different.
There is some there are some funds contemplated in this $67 million for transitional housing that don't know exactly at this point how much. But I think that it is important to note that as far as the treatment goes, they're expecting to have 61 new treatment beds online by the end of September. We're supposed to see most of those within a week. And the VOA detox facility has opened 15 additional beds, not really through Operation Rio Grande, but coincidentally, that are coming online this month as well. So there, we'll see, very soon whether or not the state is following through on that plan.
Operation Rio Grande. And its sort of component parts march on. But Robert, before we head to a break, could this effort, the $67 million, the need to have this much money, could that, I guess what I'm wondering is, does this need to become a permanent effort? I mean, does that amount of money?
I think we're triaging the problem right now, but it will take some sustained focus on the affordable housing component of it. That's not going to be a near term solution. You've got to spend. That's got to be a continued, ongoing part of this process. And then we're still looking to 2019 to see when the shelters open and what impact that's going to have on the. It is 2019, right? Mm-hmm. And when those shelters open and what impact that's going to have on the overall issue. The way it looks, you've got this issue with some of the disbursement, the bad elements down in Pioneer Park is presumably dispersing into other neighborhoods. I think that's going to be take some months to work itself out. So this is going to be an ongoing. There's not an easy short term solution, and it's going to take years, not months.
Okay, we've got to head to our first break of the show, but thanks very much for this conversation, you guys. When we come back, we'll turn to net metering for solar customers and a potential elimination of the food sales tax. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stick around.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson, environment reporter Emma Penrod, government reporter Matt Piper, and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. As usual, we're discussing this past week's local news, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Or you can call us up. We are at 801-355-8255. Earlier this year, during Utah's legislative session, there was a proposal to raise the sales tax on food. And now there are rumblings to maybe eliminate it altogether. And those rumblings are coming from some of the same people who earlier proposed raising the tax or return it to the higher level it used to be at anyway. Lee Davidson, what gives here? What's going on? Where did this happen?
Well, it happened at an interim meeting of a committee at the legislature, and they are looking at how to reform taxes. And everyone expected them essentially to look very carefully at raising the sales tax on food. That almost passed at the end of the last legislative session. It kind of fell apart as they were trying to work on the details. And so it's a little bit of a surprise this week that several members of that committee raised the question, well, maybe it would be wiser to get rid of the food tax. How much do we really get from it? Senator Deidre Henderson, a Republican from Spanish Fork, for example, talked about when she was a young mom with young kids, and she would go to the store with the calculator, and she knew how much she could spend on food. And when the calculator showed she was done, she was done. And the talk about raising the tax on food by about 3%, she said she'd be putting things back out of her basket. And so she was urging, you know, let's take a moment here and look at this. Senator Jim DeBacchus, a Salt Lake Democrat, said he was already going to introduce such legislation to get rid of the food tax, which isn't too surprising for Senator DeBacchus. But the fact that some other Republicans are talking about it is a little surprising. Another Republican, Tim Quinn of Heber City, did some quick figuring and said, you know what, we could get rid of the food tax if we raise the tax on everything else from 4.7% for the state level to 4.95%. He says maybe it's worth it. There's a lot of problems with the food tax. It hurts the poor, they think. And it's really kind of hard sometimes to figure out what is food and what isn't food. And the State Tax Commission and grocery stores spent a lot of effort trying to figure that out. And he said, maybe if we got rid of this, you know, it would be helpful.
Advocates of the plan to raise this tax or to bring it back to the level that it had been at before, I guess, they originally argued that, that this was a restoration of the tax to that level. And that back, you know, historically was a lot higher than it is today, from what I understand. But also the plan to raise that up was to sort of add a cushion to the state budget to say food tax is always going to be something that we can rely on. Is that right?
The Senate, to back up a few years ago during the recession, hits, people don't buy as much, so it doesn't generate as much sales tax, which makes it hard to fund the state. They noticed that food sales remain pretty constant. People have to eat. And so the Senate especially said, gee, if we fully tax food, our revenues aren't so volatile. They don't go up and down so much every year. So, gee, it would make sense to restore that just so we know how much money we're going to have every year. They had some ideas. You know, they said, so you understand, the sales tax on kind of everything for the state level is 4.7%. There's a discount on food. They charge 1.75%. The idea was just raise it back on food, and then, you know, our revenues are pretty constant. We know how to budget.
Okay.
They said if we do that, maybe we could help the poor by maybe giving them an earned income tax credit. Or, you know, some people said, well, that's nice, but a lot of middle-class people, it's still going to hurt because they aren't going to qualify for that. Jim DeBacchus said, well, the poor aren't smart enough to know how to really take advantage of an earned income tax credit. If they're homeless, they're not filing income tax, and they're not going to benefit. So they're talking about that.
How many other states, Lee, have a food tax similar to ours?
I need to look it up real close, but we're in a very small minority of states that actually tax food.
Okay.
Vast majority don't. There are 5 states that have no sales tax on anything,
right,
and it's 30-plus that don't tax food.
Okay.
I also forgot to say that one thing they were looking at is if they tax food, they were going to lower the overall tax on everything else. So if food tax go up, everything else would come down a little bit.
None of this, from eliminating the food tax to the credits that that you described, the earned income credits, that will be acted upon until the next legislative session. This is an interim committee that's, I guess, studying this issue.
And the committee's trying to come up with a recommendation. There's no consensus on anything yet. They're even looking at a few other things, like maybe raise the sales tax on candy and soda, but not other types of things.
Is this a big change in tone and direction from Utah lawmakers, Lee, or is it just, I don't know, it sounds like a lot of...
It's a little surprising for some Republicans especially to be talking this way. At the end of the session, they were all gung-ho for raising the sales tax on food. It was almost a done deal. They just had trouble working out the details, and so they said, well, we'll study the details so we get things exactly right. Mm-hmm. And now they're looking at all kinds of things, not just that option.
Robert Gerke, not the most exciting topic, but one that affects a lot of people, the food sales tax, especially if you're lower income, it's going to have a big impact on your budget.
Yeah, and as Lee mentioned, it is interesting that they kind of are reversing course here. I'm not sure that this is going to take hold, and it is a small piece of the larger tax reform puzzle that they're trying to put together right now. The reduction in the sales tax on food, I think there's a broad consensus that it did help the low-income people, and that if you're going to restore it, you're going to have to come up with some way to offset that somehow. And Lee hit on the point that you can't, if people aren't filing income tax returns, then you can't give them an income tax credit to offset that. And so there's some real problems in how you kind of make that not just revenue neutral, but the neutral in the way it impacts especially low and middle income people. So, it is sort of the quintessential regressive tax, which is to say it gives more of a benefit to higher income people, more of an impact on lower income people, and it's one that, you know, it doesn't necessarily generate. It doesn't encourage people to spend or save, or, you know, right. So, yeah.
Lee Davidson, just going back to the sort of revenue neutral, the net revenue neutrality part of that, this wasn't the only thing that was floated. This only the only proposal that was floated at this interim committee meeting. There were some that had to do with manufacturing, I believe, and the amount of money that the tax credits that are given to large manufacturing.
Again, this committee is looking at all sorts of tax reforms. Mm. Goes back to the legislative session when people want, well, there's an initiative that would raise taxes significantly for schools. Governor Gary Herbert doesn't like that idea very much, saying that would hurt industry and our ability to draw jobs here. So he said, let's look at taxes overall. Maybe there are exemptions that we could get rid of and generate extra money that way. Ironically, the same committee looked at creating a new exemption, saying it's needed to attract industry. And it's about it would exempt sales tax on some machinery that is expected to last more than a year but not more than 3 years. Hmm. And believe it or not, that would be a $57 million tax break to several industries in Utah.
And it was mining and...
mining and manufacturing.
Okay.
And so Jim DeBacchus, among others, said, gee, here we are giving away money to industry again, and we're just going to hurt schools if we do it. And others were arguing, well, you know, we need to do this so that we keep our industry healthy. And if we don't do it, other states are doing it, we're going to lose manufacturing. So they're talking about giving away more money at the same time they're trying to find more money.
Well, and talking about it right now, we'll see what they do during the legislative session. Something to keep an eye on, and something that I'm sure Lee Davidson will be keeping an eye on. I want to turn to another story altogether and to environment reporter Emma Penrod. But just before I do that, a quick reminder that we want to hear your thoughts on the stories that we're talking about today. Call us at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. And Emma Penrod, for a while, solar power advocates, this is solar panel companies and advocates of solar power, and Rocky Mountain Power have been at loggerheads. But a sort of truce this week, or maybe a kind of truce, a detente might be the word to put it, a deal has been struck. What is the deal that has been struck? And actually, maybe first tell us, Emma, what the conflict was about.
Yes. Yeah, so last year, about a year ago, Rocky Mountain Power came out with this proposal to introduce a new three-part rate for charging people with rooftop solar panels for their electrical use. This would, you know, be a departure from how, you know, currently all residential customers are charged, and it would put them on this special rate that would be exclusive to people with residential solar panels. And as part of this proposal, like I said, there were three parts to it. The most controversial part was that they wanted to implement what's called a demand charge, which rather than, you know, running a meter and counting how much electricity you use and then charging you a, you know, per kilowatt hour rate for how much electricity you used, this demand charge looks at the single point in time in the month that you used the most power and then charges you according to how much power you drew during that one point in time. And it was going to be, you know, about $9 per kilowatt. This had, depending on how much you pull, which depends on kind of what kind of appliances you had in your house, if you had an electric dryer, if you had an air conditioning unit, you know, these things pull a lot of power. And if you were to be running those at the times when this charge would apply, you could rack up substantial charges in a very short period of time. And so this became a very controversial proposal. Solar advocates, you know, people in the industry, as well as, you know, clean air advocates, environmentalists, said this was, you know, intended to just kind of kill the solar industry and eliminate Rocky Mountain Power's competition. Rocky Mountain Power said, you know, well, the reason we want to do this is it sends more realistic market signals to the people in terms of how we actually generate and sell them power now that they have solar panels. And demand charges, note, are used for commercial customers in some cases. So it's not a completely new idea. It's just not something that's used a lot of the time for residential customers. And so this fight has been going on now for a year. It's really a continuation of a previous fight that, you know, has been going on for years now.
What's the deal that's struck? And some of this has to do also with I mean, I guess, what is the difference between demand charges and net metering, which we hear a lot about with solar panels? And then what's the deal that's been struck?
Yeah, so the net metering is a program that if you have, you know, solar panels on your roof, you can enroll in through Rocky Mountain Power, and they'll, you know, put a two-way meter on your house, and they'll charge you when you're using power. And then they'll actually credit you when you're producing more power than you're using and pushing it out onto the grid. That's the fundamental idea behind net metering. Rocky Mountain Power has said that the problem with this from their perspective is that right now there's kind of a one-to-one credit ratio. If you use 1 kilowatt hour, they charge you for 1 kilowatt. If you send 1 kilowatt out onto the grid, they give you 1 kilowatt's worth of credit. And Rocky Mountain Power is saying, hey, you know, we can buy power for a third that price. So why should we be forced to pay you this much money? That's, you know, their position on the matter. So they say, you know, what happens effectively is people without solar panels are being forced to unfairly subsidize their neighbors with solar panels. And of course, you know, the solar advocates say, well, it's good for our air quality, it's good for our environment, and it has a lot of even financial benefits to the grid and to neighbors around them, provides some stability. And so, you know, there's arguments on both sides of that issue.
Okay, so we've got the whole conflict between the industry and the solar panel providers. How about this deal that came out?
So the settlement then looks at, instead of creating this brand new way of charging power or charging for power, they're going to treat these people like they're any other customer. If they generate some, or if they use some of the power that they generate, they're not going to be billed for that power. It's just going to be treated like if they put in energy efficient, you know, light bulbs and, you know, didn't have to use power. If they push power out onto the grid, they're still going to get a credit for that. What will change is Rocky Mountain Power will reduce the amount that that credit is worth. So instead of being a, you know, 10 cent for 10 cents credit, they're going to drop it by about a cent. So decrease of, you know, about maybe 10% in the value of the credit initially for the first 3 years. This is according to the terms of the agreement. Then what will happen in 2020 is Rocky Mountain Power will initiate a study on exactly how much does this power, these credits actually cost the company, and how much benefit does the company get. And a bunch of people will collaborate on this study through, you know, kind of an open forum setting. And they will attempt to decide what is a fair rate for this credit and set it at a new, presumably lower than it currently is, rate going forward after 2020.
Okay. And some of this, there's a short time frame for some people. If you, for example, within the next couple of months install solar panels, or if you've had solar panels installed historically, you can sort of maintain the current rate through 2035 or something like that. Is that correct?
Okay. Yeah, getting grandfathering in was a big deal for the solar industry. In a lot of cases, they have gone to people and they've sold them solar panels on the basis that their bill will be X amount for the next X number of years, and therefore they'll make all the money that they paid for the solar panels back in these costs that they didn't have to pay on their electrical bill. So being able to honor these agreements was very important to the solar industry, and that was maybe a concession that went in on Rocky Mountain Power's side to say, okay, we will grandfather in anyone who signs up for our net metering program before November 15th, 2017, and then those people will be locked into the current rate structure through 2035.
Okay. And then there's a second sort of block of people who have a three-year period. I know this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but if you buy after that November date, then you have 3 years at a different rate. Is that correct?
Or yeah, that's the new transition rate. It's a 9.2 cents per kilowatt hour for residential customers, and that will apply to anyone who signs up for net metering after November 15th.
Okay.
Of this year.
And
going forward, that will be what it will be. And then those people will get the new rate that's determined in 2020 after the three-year rate expires.
And we just don't know what that is yet.
We don't know what
okay.
it is yet.
Okay. Maybe this is a question for Robert Gerke, actually, but is solar power from people's homes somehow a threat to Rocky Mountain Power? Or is this just about sort of capturing money that they would otherwise be making? I don't know. Or losing?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. And I've heard people compare Rocky Mountain Power to the old Ma Bell AT&T landlines in the age of cell phones, when you've got this dispersed generating capacity, when you've got solar panels on people's roofs, you don't need the hard lines that used to run to your house. You don't need the telephone poles because it's all cell technology. I don't know if that's necessarily accurate, but it could be moving in that direction. I think they did look into the future and see that this is going to continue to grow. And while it was a small subsidy that was being paid to these rooftop solar people, now somewhere on the order of about 38 cents a month per customer. If that industry continues to grow, then that subsidy is going to get higher, and the costs become greater. I think, you know, down the road, especially as we see battery technologies improving, you're going to see these rooftop solar people able to go completely off the grid, just cut their line to Rocky. And you know, so I think there is something that the company is going to have to try to adjust to as it goes forward. I think this negotiated settlement they came up with, well, it's exactly what I told them they should do, so I'm glad they listened to me. But it does address the problems, and I think the grandfathering component was huge, because we saw in Nevada they passed a bill where they changed their net metering program in such a way that it pretty much wiped out about a third of the solar industry overnight. It still hasn't really come back. I mean, they repealed it within a few months. But without the grandfathering provision in there, all these people who have made these long-term leases on this solar equipment are just going to, you know, get kicked in the teeth. And so the grandfathering provision is a crucial component of it. And now they can focus on what a fair rate is going forward.
Well, you say now, except for Emma, this is not quite a done deal because it still needs to be approved, right?
Yes. Anytime Rocky Mountain Power is a regulated utility, wants to change what it's charging people, it has to go through the Public Service Commission, which will determine whether or not this is a fair and acceptable rate in terms of how much money Rocky Mountain Power is allowed to make.
Okay. Guys, we have to turn to another break. It's just that time of the show. We will circle back in a little bit. But right now, yeah, to a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. More from this past week's news just ahead.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Piper, Lee Davidson, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke. Weigh in with your comments and questions during this Friday morning news wrap-up by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Matt Piper, let's come back to some Salt Lake City news now. Salt Lake City International Airport news, actually. The airport is being expanded, and there have been questions about the planned extension of the TRAX light rail line to the new terminal. Questions about how that would be funded, because it had a big price tag. And actually, this story is kind of in flux now, and the price tag might be dropping. This is as of a couple of days ago.
Yeah. So 2008. I know I always start by backing up, and it's like, oh God, he said 2008. So in 2008, UTA agreed when the tracks was extended to the airport that they would pay for a future relocation of the tracks because they knew the airport was going to grow. The airport is now growing, and for a long time we've thought that the best way, all involved have sort of said that the best way for tracks to meet this new terminal would be to elevate it and to have it sort of go into the front of the parking structure at the second level where people would get off and go across a sky bridge into the gleaming new terminal. That was going to cost $68 million, though, and UTA had said, we just don't have it. We are, you know, a debt-ridden agency. Everyone knows that right now. We thought we were signing up for something that was going to be in the order of $5 million to $15 million, and we just can't do this, and we need help if you want to do this. So for a year now, the city, the mayor's office and UTA have had negotiations where seemingly the mayor's position has been, you agreed to pay for this. The city is not going to pay for this. And UTA said, well, then our options are limited. And it was either build the $68 million elevated extension that gets you right up to the skywalk, or stop it 1,200 feet short and have a people mover or a bus or, you know, you maybe just walk a long way to the terminal.
Moving sidewalk?
And so there's always a potential at an airport for a moving sidewalk.
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, there's apparently a new option. The new option is to build instead of elevating it, to just sort of extend the track at grade, they say, so at street level, mm-hmm. to the new terminal. And you say, well, why couldn't you just do that all along? This option is 1/4 the cost. It's like something less than $15 million, they think, the city's airport engineers think. Mm-hmm. And the answer is apparently that this was ruled out early because it may impinge on the taxiways if they are to extend the airport in the future. Mm. And because it still may not be the ultimate dream scenario from a transit standpoint compared to the elevated tracks extension. So it saves a lot of money. There's another drawback, too, and this is sort of news today. Some communications that we haven't reported on yet, it became clear that you're looking at like a 9 to 15 month bus bridge. They can't build this at-grade extension, the cheaper one, until the new terminal opens in 2020 and they've cleared out the old terminal. Hmm. So that's going to be a pretty big interruption to the ideal service down there at the airport that you would have. While they built this thing, 9 to 15 months, where that you'd have your last stop would be on North Temple, and then you'd take a bus to the airport
from the tracks line there. Wow. Okay. So the idea, though, it's cheaper not to elevate it, to keep it at grade, as you said, and that's where the majority of the costs were the raising of the line. The city council needs to sign off on this, and I know that Mayor Biskupski revealed a bit of this, but not all of it, at the city council meeting this week. That was something that council members were unhappy with. What do they think? What do the city council members think of the new plan? Do we know?
We don't really know yet because, as you said, the mayor has had sort of previously cloaked this in secrecy, saying that she had been instructed to do so by UTA, which has to present this to their airport It's first of all, it's a city airport plan, but UTA has to vet it and present this to their board because they're going to pay for it ultimately. And the mayor said, you know, they have the right to hear that first, kind of. And we've been instructed to hold off. UTA then kind of came back minutes later and said, actually, you know, you can talk about this. We don't have a problem with you having a discussion about this now. And so, you know, it was kind of an ugly moment for the mayor because she had some council members who were pretty critical of her, keeping them in the dark. And they sort of set her up in a way by saying, you know, who told you can't share this information? What information did they say you can't share? And then, you know, within the hour, we knew that at least was a misunderstanding
between the city and UTA. Yeah. But this story is essentially awaiting conclusion now. We don't know what the city council will do. We don't know if this proposal is the final straw, the final, you know, plan.
Correct.
Okay. Well, we will see where it goes. Another story today awaiting conclusion. Just in the couple of minutes that we have left, I want to turn to back to Emma Penrod. And you know, we're going to run out of time here soon, Emma, so we'll have to keep it kind of quick. But you had a story about a group of business leaders, some of them pretty heavy hitters, who are calling for more immediate action over the state's poor air quality. Who are we talking about and what are they saying?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there were some names you'd expect to see, like Patagonia and some outdoor retailers. But what was interesting, perhaps, was the signing of certain, you know, notable Utah brands like Zions Bank, the Mark Miller, you know, car dealerships, Ancestry.com, that they had also signed this petition saying we really need to see some faster action about the air quality because we're having a hard time with recruiting and with getting our employees to come out here and work for us.
Okay, so that's it. It has to do with attracting employees because of poor air quality. This comes at a moment when the state of Utah, is facing some deadlines, air quality deadlines from the EPA that we're not going to meet?
Yeah, the state is saying at this point it seems unlikely we will meet this deadline at the end of the year. Because we missed a deadline in 2015 for complying with federal standards for small particulate pollution, that's the stuff that we get in the winter during the inversions, we were supposed to have cleaned that up by 2015. We didn't. So now the state is required to submit a new plan to the EPA, which is due December 31st of this year. And earlier this month, some state officials said, you know, if we were going to do that, we needed to have our plan ready to propose to the state air board by September, and it's not going to be ready. And so we're probably not going to make that deadline.
Okay, so these employers are calling, these big companies are calling for drastic measures that are, you know, not being taken right now. What might those drastic measures that we need to take be, and what does the state say about this petition that these companies have put together?
Well, they've called for what they're calling bold and innovative moves. They would like to see more regulation of wood smoke, something to, you know, regulate when people can use their fireplaces or wood stoves, those kinds of things. They've also said that we need to look more at transportation and see if we can eliminate some, you know, emissions from vehicles, especially maybe heavy duty vehicles and diesels. These are things that the state says that are not off the table, that they are considering. But the state says they're hung up right now with some technical details, with some modeling that's not coming together as quickly as maybe they would have liked.
Any you know, sort of implicit threat from these companies about moving their convention out of town or shades of outdoor retailer is what I'm thinking of here. Well, Emma, thanks very much for the reporting. We'll keep an eye on it. And guys, we have got to leave it there because it's time for us to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And you all know the drill. Gerke, maybe I'll start with you. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, I was just looking at it. I think the story was from last week, so now I'm embarrassed. But Lee Davidson did a story last week about the gun licensing fees that was being charged. And I think it was your story. No, I'm doubly embarrassed. But anyway, there was a legislative hearing last week. The Bureau of Criminal Investigation has been charging an extra $20 to do these fingerprint checks on concealed weapons permits. And the legislature didn't like that. They said when we passed that bill allowing you to charge $20, we were only talking about other licensed people, teachers and things like that, you know, school officials, custodians, that sort of thing. BCI said, well, the expense, we need to charge this $20. And so that, you know, increased the fee for those people getting concealed weapons permits. And now the legislature is considering telling them to roll that back and get rid of it because the gun owners are not happy with the increase in the concealed weapons fees.
Check. Find that at sltrip.com. I can't remember who the reporter was on that. Emma Penrod, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, so this was a quirky thing that happened earlier this week. The state Department of Agriculture and Food is ordering just about 30 businesses to stop selling hemp-infused dog treats. Which is apparently not allowed because hemp is not an approved ingredient in dog food because it's not been tested and proven safe for dogs to eat.
But it is safe for people to eat.
It's a health fad right now. If you go to, you know, a Whole Foods or something like that, you can probably buy some hemp seeds. It's plant protein.
Okay. Not for dogs. Matt Piper, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, so University of Utah research associate in a play on the phrase bleed red has actually branded his own red blood cells with some sort of, hang on, here we go. I have to look this up.
It's with the U logo.
A nanoscale ion beam with the he used a nanoscale ion beam, 1,000 times thinner than the width of a human hair to brand his own blood cells. With the U logo, and it had an immediate impact as Utah beat North Dakota Thursday night.
Of course, so. It was that. That's what did it.
It's good to see us putting our scientific capabilities to good tech, good use, right?
But Lee Davidson, your pick.
There's been a lot of talk nationally about trying to get rid of Confederate monuments, and to show how quickly the pendulum can swing. There's a story today about the Treasury Department having second thoughts about putting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. Apparently, they're having second thoughts that was going to happen in 2020 to replace Andrew Jackson, a slaveholder. Treasury Secretary said they have other bigger things to focus on, so apparently that's being put on the back burner.
Wow. That's interesting. I'm going to go with, for my pick for underplayed story, the movie theater Broovies winning its case against the state of Utah. This has to do with their showing the movie Deadpool and also selling beer, which violated a Utah law banning the serving of alcohol during films with nudity or simulated sex. Judge David Nuffer ruled in favor of Broovies on First Amendment grounds, and it's an interesting read. And you'll see in the article that it has implications for Utah liquor law, which is interesting. Check it out at sltrib.com. Lee Davidson, Matt Piper, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
That's it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, Tom Williams, Spencer Hulsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen manage the broadcast at Utah Public Radio. And thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. We are glad you could join us today. Have a great holiday weekend.